From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
The national commentators will usually have that context and those
notes
in the lead up as well. So when you get the vignette of the country,
Mustache Jeep and Bailey's.
Yeah.
We end with, you know, some real bangers like Bohemian Rhapsody, maybe a bit of the Beatles, Frank Sinatra. I mean, it can go anywhere. This is the beauty of Day Fever.
And we're trying to work with the local authority to make plots available for local people at a reduced rate.
Coming up on this sunny Monday edition of Playback Daily, slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, ranking the Eurovision favourites, Dancing in the Light, Day Fever comes to Dublin, and that they may face the rising sun. A new cemetery near Wolfetone's burial place. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that just flat refuses to believe that anyone can dance for 5 hours. It's never happened and it never will. We'll start where we usually do, with the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan. And it was a racy opening by any measure.
Did you watch the Grand National, the Aintree Grand National Liz of the weekend? Did you win anything? Because it was an extraordinary day for Willie Mullins and for Irish Equestrian, as it keeps getting the incredible, just unbelievable success for the men and women in that sport abroad. We are global champions for sure. Up to 500 million viewers tuned into the world's most famous steeplechase, dwarfing the close on 6 million tuning in on ITV for just British TV viewers, and the 60,000 in attendance on the ground in Aintree. This is from Brian O'Connor, the racing correspondent, in this morning's Irish Times. And he's saying, those decrying the modern National as a pale facsimile of its former challenge couldn't deny the drama of Saturday's outcome. So even the consummate professional that is Willie Mullins, 68 years of age, who has seen everything and redefined racing himself, reduced to tears, choking back. He could barely speak. He obviously, his trained horse won, Nick Rocket, 33-1. His son, Patrick, was on board Nick Rocket, and he is an amateur, the most successful amateur rider in history, plotting a course towards 1,000 career winners. An absolutely incredible, memorable victory. I think it would be the most memorable of all. And Nick Rocket is obviously going to be in this. But also the owner of Nick Rocket is a fellow called Stuart Andrew. And he owned the horse with his wife, Sadie, and she died in December 2022 from motor neuron disease. So every possible layer of kind of grief and triumph all folding together as Willie Mullins took to the microphone on live television.
Even you appear to need to pinch yourself about this.
Yeah, well, to be able to leg your son.
Willie, take a moment. Patrick.
Yeah,
the winning owners.
It's lovely to be able to give your son a ride in the National, but I should be able to win it. Just unbelievable.
We'll come back in a minute, Willie.
Yeah.
He should have kept going. He was coming around, Willie Mullins, but some grown men are going, oh, emotion and tears. We must leave this moment immediately. Extraordinary win. The first, second, third, and fifth Willie Mullins trained horses, and you don't see Willie Mullins literally incapable of speech. Such was that moment. Extraordinary, extraordinary.
The Sporting Weekend Review continued with some choice words on the rugby that was played.
As we know, Leinster were heading up towards Croke Park. I wonder if they made their way home at this stage. A lot of cars, I believe. Leinster Harlequins, 55,000. Or that was sold out, wasn't it? 55,000 anyway, we know, Croke Park. 62-0 was the result. 10 tries. I mean, was it worth going up there at all? Not much crack at that at all. And what they were calling the Ronan O'Gara Derby, which was Munster versus La Rochelle. Of course, Munster won with an incredible drop goal from Jack Crowley, the man of the moment in number 10, which will just only heat up that contest for the Irish number 10. Rod did one of his entertaining post-match interviews as ever. It's only quotes I can get around the place. He's just talking about peach of a drop goal. In fact, he's so entertaining in his post-match thing. He said he was watching Jack at several moments until he remembered, oh, he's not on my team. He's for the other ones. I'm French now and it's Munster. He said, a peach of a drop goal. I was thinking that little effer. His reference to Jack Riley's goal. So, of course, he tried to sign him for La Rochelle once, but it didn't work out. And meanwhile, in the Champions Cup tie between Toulouse and Sale, it was delayed by 40 minutes because a parachutist who was delivering the match ball, God almighty, this is the nightmare for the poor parachutist, he got stuck on the roof of the stadium and was left dangling from the roof of Stadium de Toulouse. but the parachute got snagged in the awning. They had to clear all the supporters and the packed stand, all the anticipation and excitement in the huge area below them, 30 metres stranded into the air. And then the fire brigade arrived out and they got a cherry picker and had to rescue him with a huge cheer from the crowd, hanging there for 25 minutes. That's actually quite quick. 25 minutes to get him out. But the mortification of the poor man. I mean, it's just, it ended safely and well. So we can look, and look at the photograph here. It's just, yeah, he's right over the inflatable ball and everything. That's just... The poor man. Will he get into a parachute? I hope he does. You know, I suppose it's memorable in some way. Can you look at it that way? Well, Ariel Mullins have done that. The Ulster Championship is up and running. Malachy Clerkin tells us Donegal up and running and running and running. Kicking occasionally too, hand passing. This is the new rules in the Championship. But I love the way he says here, in the first 25 minutes, Donegal versus Derry. So you'd be expecting usual kind of blanket defence, puke football, as Pat Spillane famously called it once. All over now, of course, with the new rules. But he says, for the first 25 minutes, it was as though both teams were sending a message. You can sing Imagine on a Zoom call with Jim Gavin all you like, but you're in Bally Buffet. This is the Ulster Championship. Hey, 5 points apiece with 10 minutes to go to the break, which would be the standard fare. But by halftime, it was 112 to 15. So there you go. It was quite windy. Donegal won very, very 125 to 150. Imagine 125 in an Ulster Championship. The new rules are working spectacularly.
Which is just how that word is pronounced in Monaghan GAA circles. From the sporting life to the avian life.
Michelle McKeown writes environmental matters in the Irish Examiner, and she's a brilliant writer actually, and she's talking about seagulls. She appeals to our kinder senses when it comes to animals that we think are a threat to our very existence and so on. And seagulls, the main culprit behind the chip theft, the seagulls who dive bomb for your lunch basically, and she's speaking on their behalf and to ask you to think differently about them. Starting with the basics, not all gulls are equal. The main culprit behind the chip theft is the herring gull, but the lesser black-headed gull and the great black-headed gull, which she says, just imagine a seagull with gym membership, are also suspects. Do you know, you see the seagulls who look absolutely enormous. So you're actually seeing the black-backed gull, which is the giant one, because you go, are they all that size? No, they're not. So she says, over time, seagulls have moved from remote cliffside colonies into town cities and tourist hotspots, becoming urban adapted snatchers. Why go fishing when you can get a free panini off an unsuspecting pedestrian? She's saying, in one study, gulls are more likely to steal a food item than a human has just handled. Why? Because they associate our interest with high quality snacks. That's how smart these guys are. They're going, that human really is really enjoying that sandwich over there. I'm sure that's a very good sandwich. As good a review as any, in I go. Now, other research does suggest they still prefer the seafood, their natural diet, over the urban diet, which is our food. But it's not their fault. You might feel like gulls are taking over the planet. The main point here is basically the overfishing. We have stolen their food. They're coming for ours. And you might feel like gulls are taking over the planet. But in truth, she says, many gull species are in decline. The herring gull, despite its street cred, is on the red list of birds of conservation concern in Ireland. Since the 70s, numbers have plummeted because of the overfishing, egg collection, pollution and all the stuff we're doing. Changes in waste management because the landfills are being cleaned up and so on, so they don't get to go hang out there. So they're looking for our food. It is easy to demonise seagulls, but beneath the screeches and snack attacks lies a bird doing what evolution has trained it to do, survive. The next time a gull tries to lift your lunch, remember, they're not evil. They're feathered survivors navigating a changing world, one chip at a time. They're smarter than we think, hungrier than we realise, and more misunderstood than a teenager in a hoodie. So if you must dine al fresco, hold your sandwich tight, stare the gull down and whisper, not today.
Don't know about you, but tactics for combating predatory seagulls was not on my bingo card for Oliver Callan this morning. But maybe everyone living near or visiting the shore this summer will be grateful for those tips. And with that, we'll draw a veil over our excerpt from the Oliver Callan monologue for another day. May all your chips stay out of the beaks of seagulls. On this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Dunleary People Before Profit TD Richard Boyd Barrett had a non-political announcement he wanted to make.
I wanted to take the opportunity to say I recently got a cancer diagnosis, and I found out a few weeks ago, and I have to enter into a fairly intense period of cancer treatment over the next Well, it's going to certainly take a couple of months, probably. All in all, we could be talking 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it means I won't be around. They've said I need to kind of step back and throw everything at recovering.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to explain that? I wanted to explain your absence, I suppose.
Absolutely, because I'm just if I just disappeared, people, the constituents, obviously, who elected me, would mm-hmm. be wondering where I'm gone. So I wanted to do them the service of telling them, people who voted for People Before Profit, I think deserve to know if I'm not around. And I just want to stress, I plan to be back as soon as possible. I need to throw everything
right,
at this.
So you need to step back. Will we just talk about what's happened? I mean, you said you got the diagnosis quite recently. So when did you start to notice that there might be something wrong?
I noticed about the end of October and November. I was actually in the middle of the election campaign. I was shaving and I noticed a swelling in my neck. And I left her for a few weeks, which I probably shouldn't. But anyway, I moved fairly fast. Mm-hmm. Just before Christmas, I went to the doctor. And then I sort of got into the system. Storm Eowyn actually affected a little bit my getting into the system because I had my first appointment on that day and that was cancelled. But very shortly afterwards, and it's been very good, I have to say, the cancer services have been very good. I was in and they suspected that it was cancer. They had to do an operation to look in, biopsy. I ended up having to get my tonsils taken out and they found that I had throat cancer that was prompted by the HPV virus, which I don't know if people know. I didn't know that much about it, but apparently about 70 or 80% of the population have. It can be sitting in your system for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor said you probably picked this up years ago. And then it can just activate.
Right.
Because of age, because of stress, because of your immune system being down or whatever.
Probably unlikely to find out why it activated in the way
I think so. They certainly didn't speculate on that. They just said that happens. I mean, there is now a vaccination program for young women. I think they're starting, or there is available vaccines for young
for
men
boys.
As well.
Yeah.
Which apparently stops the move to become cancerous later in life.
Right.
But anyway, that wasn't around when, or yeah. I wasn't aware of it when I was younger. So
it's throat cancer you've been diagnosed
throat
with.
Throat cancer, yeah. And now when it's virus induced, apparently that does improve, according to the doctors, your chances of recovery. The doctors have said it is very curable. So I have a good chance. It's been caught relatively early because it was in my tonsil. It's gone to my lymph nodes, but no further. So I have to get radio and chemotherapy. And they say the chances of, you know, that working are about 8 to 9 out of 10, which is good. But obviously, you know, you could be unlucky and not, you know, be the 1 in 10 or the 2 in 10 that it doesn't work for. So you have to throw everything at it. Mm. And apparently the treatment is fairly rough. After a few weeks, it starts to get pretty rough.
So I bet you said, can I not work through this? Did you?
Well, I asked about that. And, you know, friends and my work colleagues have been saying, you need to step back. And the doctor, certainly the chemotherapist doctor, was fairly adamant. I needed not to work during this and mm-hmm. throw everything at it and get myself, because it can be tough. And you've got to maintain basically yourself through a treatment that can take its toll on you.
Right.
Apparently eating and drinking can get pretty rough during it.
But how are you now as we sit here now?
To be honest, I'm fine. When I got the tonsils out, because when you get them late in life, that's rough. And for a few weeks, that was, you know, that was sore, very, very sore. A lot of painkillers. But other than that, I feel grand. But yeah, it has to be acted on.
Mm-hmm. So when you were going through the election campaign, you didn't know what you had, but you knew there was something wrong. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I knew I had to get to the doctor and get it checked out.
Mm-hmm.
But the election campaign was very stressful. I didn't really want to preoccupy myself with having to do that as well. So I waited until that was over and then went to the doctor just before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. But did you find that campaigning was harder for you because this was on your mind, or did you feel unwell at that time?
No, I didn't feel unwell.
And you just had this lump.
It's swelling. Would describe it as. Mm-hmm. But yes, that is the cancer having travelled from the tonsil, where apparently it's very difficult for people to detect it because you wouldn't know there was anything particularly wrong. But when the swelling starts, that's mm-hmm. quite often how it is identified.
Mm-hmm. But you felt okay at that time?
I felt absolutely okay. Yeah.
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 But it's a, I would imagine it's a huge shock to get, is it? To be told?
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is a shock. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I'm heartened by the confidence of the doctors that this, you know, there's a very good chance of it being done. And I think a lot of people get through it. I think the majority of people get through it. So hopefully I will too.
Yeah.
And the various people I've been dealing with have been fantastic.
And how have people in your own life responded? I mean, you spoke about colleagues there, you know, urging you to take the time out and step back. But you've got family to think about, even doing this interview, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, I wanted to let the public know and my constituents that, you know, that I won't be around for a while. I do want to stress, by the way, my office in Dunleary will stay open. Breed Smith has agreed to help out.
Great. Good for Breed.
A retired TD, for those who, I'm sure people know Breed Smith, and there's been some great support to help keep the office going. So there will be a service. In a rather remarkable and not great coincidence, one of my fellow councillors has also got a cancer diagnosis in Dunleary, Melissa Halpin, which is a bit rough. So just to say that to constituents, we'll be a bit stretched for the next few months, but there is going.
But you'll be there, and it'll be open, and all the rest.
My family, yeah, I mean they've been great. It's obviously a shock for them, but everybody is rooting for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very aware. Tens of thousands of people get these diagnoses, so. You know,
yeah, but it's important also to hear someone like you talk about it, you know, and just say, I will not be around for the next couple of months because I need to devote myself to this treatment. That's a good thing for people to hear, I think, that you're doing that.
Yes, it is. And if I could just give a shout out for our health service and our workers, in particular workers in the health service in all of this. I've been campaigning on the pay and numbers thing about staffing, and I had talked to people in Luke's, for example, in the autumn last year when I heard about this, and they were saying they need more staff. So I just want to give a shout out for them, and I hope that the government's commitments to resolve the staffing issues will be met.
Dunleary People Before Profit TD Richard Boyd Barrett talking to Claire Byrne this morning about his recent cancer diagnosis. Eamon called Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about a new cemetery in Kildare, right next to the burial place of Wolfe Tone, which he feels is exploiting the great patriot's reputation. Solicitor Satanta Landers then spoke to Joe about the new cemetery, which he is involved in administering.
What do you think of Eamon's criticism? You were commodifying our Fenian dead.
I can understand how that looks to Eamon, but I mean, I need to sort of set out the context of this graveyard and the people behind it and the plans for it. So the graveyard is owned by the McCarthy family, ultimately. There's a company there that owns it.
Okay.
The McCarthys are from Bodenstown. Jim McCarthy Sr. came up from Kerry in 1941. He was the foreman of the Salins Meat Factory, and he purchased the land in 1995 and opened a meat factory. They would have supplied a lot of meat in the 90s and 2000. The current family, Jim's mother and father are buried in the Wolfe Tone Cemetery. His two sisters and a brother buried in the Wolfe Tone Cemetery.
Okay.
The family home is within half a kilometre of the cemetery. So Seamus McCarthy, who has lived in the locality, is sort of the driving individual behind this. Mm-hmm. And this is a development that's needed for the locality, in that the population growth in Salin and Bodenstown is in the last 20 years is just exponentially grown, and Naas and places like that. So with that comes a requirement or a need for local mm-hmm. services, one of which is a graveyard. Now, when this graveyard was launched, we reached out to the local authority, and it should be mentioned that, you know, to get a graveyard, you have to put in for planning permission.
Of course,
so that
yeah.
planning permission was put in and granted, and very few in fact, no objections to the location. There was issues around access, and that's perfectly fine. And we're trying to work with the local authority to make plots available for local people at a reduced rate, because the owner ultimately is for the locality. Now, we haven't had engagement or too much engagement with the local authority, but we have communicated with them and asked them to come in, talk to us and have that discussion, because local people ought not be paying the sort of the market rate. And I want to sort of talk about the pricing, if that's okay, Joe.
Yeah, please do.
The pricing is set by virtue of the demand. And there is a national monument there, and there is a demand to be closer to the national monument, so the pricing reflects that. But the land was purchased back in 1995 to graze cattle for the meat factory. So they own all the land around the mm-hmm. cemetery, and they want to put in a sort of a second phase of development, which is a crematorium. There's no crematorium in Kildare at all at the moment. And also an interpretive centre, because Wolfe Tone, if anyone has gone down and walked this land, it's a fabulous national monument. There's a church there, there's his graveyard, yeah. and the graveyard itself is very, it's in a terrible state of disrepair.
Yeah, I agree
and
with
this
that.
Hopefully
yeah.
will bring it back to life. And with an interpretive centre, that then creates a sort of a destination for the locality. You see all of the wonderful things they've done in Glasnevin with tours of the graveyard. That is the ultimate plan. It's not a developer coming in trying to sell plots. It's trying somebody from the locality trying to develop a resource for the locality.
But did you... Okay, I take the point about pricing, but for example, in Glasnevin, which is where there's over 1 million buried, our most famous cemetery, and probably the most expensive as well, given its demand, you can get a grave there for €1,875. You can get a grave in the garden section, two burials, 4,800. The purchase of a grave in the old Finglas section, which my understanding is on the right hand side as you're coming from town, that's 8,000. But you're looking for 12,500 to be buried close to the wall nearest to Wolfe Tone.
Well, if we look at those pricing. So Glasnevin, the purchase of the old Finglas section is actually €8,950. So that's €9,000. And certain sections of Glasnevin, bear in mind the historical sections are closed. You can't get access to unless it's some form of state burial or somebody in office. So
yeah, hang on. You can't buy a plot there. Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. It's not available to the market. Yeah. And we're dealing with supply and demand.
Yeah, but what Glasnevin is going for it is it is in a very central location, probably the most central location. It's not the dead centre of Dublin, but it is in the central location in the capital, so there is a premium there in terms of people being able to visit. Bowdenstown isn't exactly on the dart, is it?
Oh, the Bowdenstown is very accessible. So if you drive down, there's a new bypass that was put in for the Kerry Group. So it was two lanes and now it's three lanes as far as the Kerry Group. And there is a new exit that comes off at the Kerry Group and is about 400 metres away from this graveyard. So it's very, very accessible.
Mm-hmm. And you said you want to charge less for locals. Well, why do you need permission from the county council to charge less for locals?
Sorry, so what normally happens with local graveyards is they're administered by the county council. So the county council would need to be the administrator of that because they have their own internal pricing mechanisms, and we want to be, reflective of that and consistent with what they do in the graveyards that they already control. So we want to engage with them, set aside a certain amount of plots, and engage with the local authority.
And what, hand them over to the council?
No, it wouldn't be handed over, but it would be at a much reduced rate.
Well, just do it.
Oh, I'd love to. Engagement.
Well, why do you need their engagement? You got planning permission for the cemetery. You're going to open a cemetery. You say the company want to charge... I don't know how you define locals, by the way. Is there someone living there in a specific geographical, political, urban, county council, delineated area? You say you want to charge locals less than 12,500 to be close to Wolfe Tone. Just do it.
Okay, but how you define locals? Is anyone from Kildare that's administered by Kildare County Council?
Okay.
Solicitor Satanta Landers talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about a new private cemetery in Bowdenstown, County Kildare. Back on Oliver Callan and a discussion about this year's Eurovision Song Contest with journalist, broadcaster and co-host of the For Tech's Sake podcast, Elaine Burke, a self-confessed Eurovision nerd. Oliver took us through the favourites, and there are quite a few of them, and he also mentioned the Irish entry. And when he asked her for her opinion on Like a Party, Elaine was pretty clear with her verdict.
It's not my favourite. But I do think Emmy got the memo, because now, having looked at the 37 entries, there's definitely a theme of dance music being big
this
year.
That's right. That's right.
Like, there's a real common thread there. And also there's an internationality going on this year.
What's going on there?
I'm sure people are aware that Emmy is herself not from Ireland. Yeah. The writer of the song is originally from Russia. And that's why we have this, like, Laika references Soviet era dog that was sent to space. It's a very strange little story.
Is the writer Russian?
Yeah, well, Irish and Russian. Has been living in Ireland for a very long time. I'm pretty sure has Irish citizenship. Okay. Yeah. So
Larissa Tormey from Kilbeggan. Is she not the writer?
Yeah, there's two, writers,
yes,
I think,
yes,
on this
song.
Well,
there's going to be multiple writers. Yeah. I get you.
I should remember her name. I'm so sorry.
But, dear, the nerds are not going to like you.
But this internationality is really common this year. So you actually have, like, loads of acts singing in languages that aren't their country's language and referencing things that are from... It's very, like, we are European, I feel, is the vibe this year.
We haven't seen anything like this before. There were rules in certain countries. The French have to sing in French.
Yeah, I think that's because there's, like, a language body in France that's very protective of the French language.
They have a quota on English language songs they can play on the radio and so on.
Yeah, and I presume that that's part of the involvement there. France always sings in French. French is a very beautiful language as well, to do a ballad in.
To be a ballad. And the Finns are speaking German.
The Finns are speaking German. The Swedes are Finns who speak a certain dialect of Swedish. And Estonia is doing a tribute to Italian.
We'll come to that. Very controversial tribute. And San Marino, which is called Tutta d'Italia, one of my favourites.
Yeah.
I thought it was the Italian one. I was going, oh, it's a bit on the nose.
You would totally think it's the Italian one. This should be the Italian football chant for the next few years, because it's very football chanty. It will get a crowd going, I'd say.
You were thinking of, I've got all the names of the Irish writers. I'm afraid to say any of them. There are 6 writers. Like a Party. So that's why you suddenly
blanked on all of those names. Yes.
Blanked to know everyone. 37 entrants is quite something. Okay, so we had Nemo, which is setting the standard, really. But we'll start off with the Netherlands, which it's Dutch, but he's singing in...
Bit of French.
In French.
Yeah.
And this is, well, French and English, isn't it? It's called C'est la vie.
C'est la vie.
So it's going to be a very confusing year if
hard to tell who you're voting for.
This is a good tune. You think this is going to do well?
I think it's a nice little bop. It is one of the stronger contenders in terms of, like, what people are assessing to be a strong contender. It's not one of my favourites, but nothing against it. It's just not standing out for me.
What are your favourites, more dancey ones?
Oh, yeah. Like, I like Sweden, and that scares me that I like Sweden.
We're coming to it. Okay.
A lot of people will only watch these things fresh on the night, and you've got 3 minutes to stand out. And C'est la vie is a nice one because it's got a hook that you can remember. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people will probably be humming that now later on today, having heard just a few seconds of it. And C'est la vie is a phrase everybody knows. So no matter what language, you might be able to catch on to it.
And he's Ned Claude.
Claude.
And he's from the Congo originally. So there's an internationality to the whole thing that's happening. Okay, Israel are one of the big favourites as well. Again, they have been for nearly every year in the last while, haven't they?
Essentially, Israel has a huge fandom going to this event and into Eurovision. And I suppose they have a really strong, like, kind of like Ireland has, like, a really strong diaspora for voting. Yeah. You know, if you have people all over the world and different nations able to contribute to your vote, that's kind of to your advantage. So I think that's
why didn't we go into the continent? Went to countries that don't.
Israel's always performed really well. They've won a good few times as well. And their entrance this year, they've kind of gone down like a soft ballady type of route.
Obviously, huge protests last year. Yes. And they had to alter their song as well. That was Hurricane, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about October 7th, and some of the lyrics were deemed to be too political. Now, this is something that happens a lot with Eurovision. You get people who kind of use euphemistic phrases and stuff like that to get political messaging across, and we've got other kinds of euphemism happening this year. But New Day Will Rise is also about October 7th, and it's sung by Yuval Raphael. But obviously, everything has been cleared by the EBU. They hadn't had any controversy this time, as far as I know, around the song.
Likely to be booed again.
But
obviously,
again, there will no doubt be controversy. There's been controversy around Israel's participation in Eurovision since before the last number of years, every time I've gone to like a Eurovision event, there's been some kind of protest against Israel's involvement. So that's not something that's new to the community. And last year, even at the rehearsal show, there was boos, very loud boos, and there was people who walked out. I was among the people who just left during the performance. I just didn't want to
This is the thing the EBU is pointing at every year, which is that this is a competition for music and it features broadcasters, not governments.
Yeah, but it is also something that people see as kind of like a soft cultural power move as well. Like there was a lot of controversy for the event that was hosted in Baku. That would have been the early noughties, I think. Yeah, because there was controversies in Azerbaijan at that time, and it was seen as a way for them to kind of music wash some of the corruption and things going on there. So that's why people, I think, are seeing this as more than a song competition, because you can kind of use it as, you know, good marketing.
We were expecting a television audience boycott in Ireland last year because of Israel's participation. It was one of the highest audiences for decades.
I think it had a counter effect where there was so much noise around Eurovision last year.
Tune in to see what's going on.
Yeah, I think people wanted to see what was happening.
The Yuval Rafael has an incredible story.
Yeah, it was actually there.
She's actually
October
at that festival.
At the music
was attacked
festival.
By Hamas on the 7th of October and survived hiding in a bomb shelter. Has shrapnel wounds, she claims as well. What do you think of the song?
Again, it's a ballad, so they're never my favourite. Now, I will say, like, sometimes ballads hit you in the moment when you're watching the show. And I do think if you're looking for the best of the ballads, it's probably France this year.
Yes.
Again, they're very good at a Frenchy ballad.
And Israel is just ahead in terms, fourth favourite, just ahead of France.
For me, you're talking about trying to stand out among 26 songs. I don't know if there's anything really stand out about it. It's actually quite similar even to Hurricane last year.
French then have Maman.
Maman, yes.
And now we're into the big guns.
And Luan had quite a debut for this song, performed it at the Six Nation with like a marching band. And
that's right.
If
Luan
brings a marching
idea.
Band to Eurovision, I might be on board with this ballad, because that could be quite a spectacle.
Is this one of the reasons why we can be behind? Because the campaigning that goes on the continent is enormous. Whereas we're kind of just trying to bring the choreography to the standard of a big stadium. In France, they're already out with a marching band in a Six Nations match weeks ago.
Yeah, and a lot of the songs that we're probably going to talk about here today and a lot of the songs that are entrants have already been topping the charts in both their countries and countries across Europe. So there's that as well. So you do want to get exposure for the songs ahead of time, because a lot of fans like myself are following along even from the time that the national selection process is happening. Mm. And the more like hype you have around a song can be good. But that can also be bad, because Baby Lasagna had a lot of hype last year, and I think it had
Croatia
wound down by the time the big night came
finished
around.
Second. In the end.
Yeah.
By the way, Israel came second in the public vote last year.
Yes.
That ballot. It has to be a very good vocal performance on the night, doesn't it? Those big French ones can be risky.
Yeah, and that's the only thing that you get to have live on the night is the vocal performance. So you do need to have a very strong vocal for Eurovision, because that's the only thing that can possibly let you down, because the music, because they can't have live music for 26 songs in the quick succession that they have them on the show. The technical prowess of that would be too much for them.
Is she going to have a little mini marching band then on stage?
I hope she does. I really want to see that. And it's got that beat, that slow building beat. And there's a nice story behind it as well. Yeah,
it's the best album in the world.
It's a song for her mother who passed away when she was younger, so it's kind of like a dedication to kind of like that lost mother.
And those big press tours they do sells all those messages around, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, so they'll be doing interviews and things like that, and like the story, like you'll also get on the night for people again who are watching afresh on the night, which is a lot of the people. The national commentators will usually have that context and those in the lead up as well. So when you get the vignette of the country,
Stephen Bailey's.
Yeah, when you get the kind of the tourism vignette of the country that's being hosted, the city that's being hosted, you'll also get that bit of context for the song as well.
Just some of Eurovision nerd Elaine Burke's verdicts on some of the many favourites for this year's competition, which takes place next month. That was on this morning's Oliver Callan. There's a growing campaign in Europe to make the owners of bigger, heavier cars pay more tax to cover the costs of the damage done to roads by the weight of what are being called supersized SUVs. This morning, Claire Byrne heard from Neil Briscoe, motoring journalist with the Irish Times and CompleteCar.ie, and from Janet Horner, Green Party councillor for Dublin North Inner City, about whether such a tax would work in this country. Claire asked Neil first if taxing heavier cars is the best way of dealing with them.
Potentially it is, actually. And in fact, taxing by the weight of the car could just possibly be the best way of replacing the current taxes that we have that are based on CO2 emissions. Because obviously, if we're moving towards electric cars and moving towards, hopefully, eventually everybody driving an electric car, then there won't be any CO2 emissions from cars to tax anymore. Mm-hmm. And the other alternative is to go to road pricing, which is where you place a tax, a payment for every journey you make. But obviously, that comes with some fairly significant privacy issues and indeed civil liberties issues. So putting a tax on the weight of a car could potentially be a very simple, very elegant, very easy way of getting around that. But then you do run into one big problem, which is that electric cars are inherently heavy because batteries, for a given amount of energy, weigh a lot more than a tank of fuel. So, you know, we want to encourage people to buy EVs, we want to encourage electric car take-up, but if you're putting a tax on weight, then you're going to be putting a big tax on electric cars. And then you run into a problem of, well, what are we encouraging here?
Yeah, well, that does seem like a contradiction if someone has moved to an electric vehicle and then they're going to get taxed, but only, Janet, if they buy a very big electric vehicle, am I right?
If you look at, for example, what Paris has done, Paris has tried to make a distinction between smaller SUVs, smaller family vehicles up to 1.6 tons. They're not been penalised in the same way that the larger SUVs are and single family vehicles or single individual vehicles are. So Paris has said any vehicle that is over 1.6 tons is going to be facing much higher parking fees within the city centre. So that is an option for us in Dublin, for example, to look at how we can distinguish vehicles along the by weight and try to recognise the ones which are oversized luxury vehicles as opposed to maybe large family vehicles, electric vehicles that people have bought and with good intentions. But I guess the issue here is that a lot of people are sort of buying the vehicles that are on the market. Like increasingly, the vehicles that are put on the market are heavier, are SUVs, are larger, and people are buying them because that's what is making the most economic sense and that's what is an offer. And I think what we need to do is start targeting the manufacturing of the vehicles, start targeting the car companies and getting them to change their system of how they evaluate what they're going to produce in order to make sure they're making ideally smaller, lighter, but safe vehicles for both people inside the vehicle, but also people outside the vehicle. And we've seen that trend change a lot over recent years, where increasingly the people inside the vehicle's safety is being prioritised, but a lot of the time at the expense of the safety of those around them, because those vehicles are ever bigger and ever heavier.
And what problems are you seeing in Dublin City with these very big cars on the road?
Well, ultimately, like our streets in Dublin were not built for cars in general. It's a very old city. But even more so, the infrastructure is not designed with vehicles of that size and weight in mind. So, you know, in the area, my area in the inner city here, you'll see areas where there's real issues with emergency vehicle access because even where there are parking spaces on the road, the vehicles no longer fit really neatly within the boundaries of those parking spaces, and it's narrowing down the carriageway so much that emergency vehicles are struggling to get past. There's the wear and tear of infrastructure. It is costing us huge amounts to upkeep our footpaths, our carriageways, because of the additional wear and tear and how intensively they are used. The efficacy of speed bumps, like we're always trying to slow down cars in the city here, but when we put in speed bumps, those really large vehicles don't feel the impact of speed bumps. So you're making it very uncomfortable for someone to cycle over them or someone in a smaller vehicle to go over them. But actually, big SUVs don't even notice them and don't slow down at all.
Okay,
so
can
we're
I bring
really struggling to slow I down just vehicles bring, as a result?
I just want to bring Neil in on that point, the wear and tear of roads, road quality being made far worse by these big SUVs. Is that a problem, Neil, in your view?
Yes, it absolutely is, because obviously a vehicle that is heavier will put more wear and tear onto the road. Incidentally, I would like to pick up one point. A car that's bigger and heavier doesn't necessarily ignore speed bumps. Ride comfort and ride quality is not directly correlated between the size and weight of the vehicle. You can have a small car that rides badly and a big car that rides badly. Trust me on that. But I do think there is a bit of an issue here, which is the Irish government in general has a terrible habit over the years of taking what are big national issues and then blaming them on individuals. So I think taking road wear and tear and blaming it on individual drivers is not really tenable at a time when, you know, we're not putting the effort into upkeep of infrastructure in general. I do think that's a serious issue.
But you did say that the bigger cars do cause more problems when it comes to wear and tear.
Yeah, they do, absolutely. And I personally, I don't disagree with the weight tax at all, because lighter cars are better, fundamentally. Whether you're talking about efficiency, whether you're talking about the fun of driving, they are better. And personally, I hate SUVs. There are a few nice ones, but mostly people shouldn't be driving them because we don't need them. I mean, you know, 99.9% of us don't need to drive up unmade roads or go climbing over mountains in our cars. And that's what an SUV was originally, theoretically anyway, designed for. We don't need them. We should be buying hatchbacks, estates, saloons. Mm-hmm. Certainly we should be buying a lot more estates because they give you the practicality of an SUV without the inefficiency.
Neil Briscoe, motoring journalist with the Irish Times and CompleteCar.ie, on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, discussing the possibility of heavier cars paying more tax, with Janet Horner, Green Party councillor for Dublin North Inner City. Jill and Sean Nealon joined Ray Darcy in studio this afternoon, and Jill, who suffers from cystic fibrosis, told Ray about the day in 2013 when the phone call came from the lung transplant team.
At that stage, I was 2 years wheelchair bound, could barely walk.
How were you feeling in yourself then?
Very ill.
Yeah.
Like I knew myself.
You're in your early 20s, are you?
I'm in my early 20s, and the only way I could describe it, Ray, is you're trapped in a body that doesn't feel like your own.
Mm.
So your mind is there. You're a young 20-something-year-old. You're thinking of all the things that you should be doing, that you could be doing, what other people are doing. And then you look down at this body that's failing you, that's attached to tubes and nebulizers.
It's letting you down.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're trapped in a body that is letting you down. It's very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've had that very active life in the lead up to that, so you know.
Yeah. So like, to go from being very independent, I worked in Dublin Airport in a really fast environment. I loved my job. I was a makeup artist on quite a high-end makeup counter at the time. And to go from that to someone who can't even wash themselves.
Right.
So it got to a point where my dad would piggyback me up the stairs to make the bath so that my mum could bath me at the age of 24 and 25.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not normal.
No, no.
And you realise, yeah, like, family is everything at that point.
And how long were you on the list for then, Jill?
So I was 18 months in total on the list. So I got listed around, would have been like June or July of 2012. And then I ended up on life support in December 2012. It was just a regular day. My twin sister was at her CF appointment. My mom took her and I said, "Mom, I'll be fine." And in true Jill fashion, I ended up taking a respiratory arrest. I ended up having a pneumothorax.
What's a respiratory arrest?
Where I couldn't breathe. I had a pneumothorax, which is a collapsed lung.
Oh, right.
And I was rushed to A&E.
Were you on your own at home?
I was on my own. And then I attempted to ring my mum in a panic, and I couldn't get the words out because I couldn't breathe. My lung had collapsed. So thankfully, she had called our neighbour, which they're like family at this point, and she came rushing in, and subsequently the ambulance was called.
Okay.
So I was brought into resource and placed on life support.
And there is that thing as well with transplants, that you have to be very sick to be on the list, but you can't be too sick.
Yeah, there's a fine line.
Yes, it's a window.
It's a fine line. And I suppose like this is where, you know, CF Ireland have been monumental in, you know, the work that they do. So they obviously allowed me to avail of their exercise grant every year. So it meant that I could even potentially buy, which I did, an exercise bike, which sat at the end of my bed. And my goal was do 10 minutes a day, 10 minutes to get yourself by, because if you didn't move the legs, you weren't going to get transplanted.
Yeah.
And
so you had to keep yourself fit, to fit enough to be suitable for a huge operation.
Yeah. I had to keep mobile. Yeah.
So when Can you remember when the call came in and what was that like?
Yeah, so it was September 2013 and it was the 20th of September. It was 9:02 at night. My mum had just come home from the hospital. Amy was just admitted for intravenous antibiotics for 2 weeks and she'd had no dinner. So I remember mum ran in, decided to make herself...
So your mum had had no dinner?
Yeah, had no dinner. And she decided to make herself like ham and cheese and coleslaw roll.
Yeah.
And I had just been to the bathroom. I was washing my hands and my phone starts ringing. And my mum was like, oh, Jill, answer that quickly. I was like, well, my hands are wet and drying my hands. Will you grab it? And she was like, that could be the matter, Jill. And I was like, yeah, and pigs will fly.
Right.
And because my mum wasn't used to an iPhone back then and I had an iPhone, she couldn't swipe the screen. But I remember screaming, going, it's the matter, Jill. It's transplant. And I was like, yeah, all right. So she managed to obviously unlock the screen, chat to them, and they said there'd be an ambulance there in 15 minutes, that there was a deceased donor.
Yeah.
And that...
Double lung transplant.
Yeah, and that there was potentially a match for me and that I needed to come in.
And had there been any false dawns?
No.
This was the first call.
My one and only call. And right. I remember saying to myself when the call came in, it's so weird because I've obviously had friends who've had like 2 and 3 false alarms and then have, you know, subsequently gone on to get their call. I had no false calls. But I knew when that call came in, just something in me, and I said to myself, these are mine.
Right.
I was like, nah. Didn't go through life support. Didn't wake up with a tracheostomy, which is the tube in my throat, thinking I'd had lungs, to be told, well, actually, no, your lung collapsed and you're on life support and you'd be lucky to make it to next year. So I said, no, this is my time to shine. This is happening.
And you did.
So never once did I think that call wasn't for me.
And it went swimmingly, the whole thing.
It did, I have to say. Yeah. Touch wood.
Yeah, you were very lucky at that stage.
My recovery was extremely well, as smooth as, you know, smooth can go after such a big operation.
And then your twin sister, Amy, was also on a list and she had a double lung transplant. So you were the first twins in Ireland to both have a double lung transplant.
The first set of twins in Ireland to be transplanted.
Yeah.
And it's so weird when I tell people, it's like... So Amy obviously was getting quite sick, but at the time she used to wheel my wheelchair around the shops and just to get me out for a couple of hours with mum. And the day I got transplanted was the day Amy went on permanent oxygen. And then when I recovered after my transplant, the roles reversed and like she needed the wheelchair. I was wheeling her around. And then thankfully Amy, I think, was 3 weeks on the list and got a call. And I think that the fact that I had waited the 18 months for my lungs, it was like unexpected to Amy. Amy just sat in the bed twiddling her thumbs thinking divine intervention was going to happen or something. And I had to literally get her off the bed. It was the middle of the night. And I said, Amy, you're going to have to work with me here. She froze. And I was like, Amy, come on. They're going to be here in 10 minutes. You know, we need to move. We need to get you dressed. We need to move. So thankfully, it was her one and only call. And that went ahead. And yeah, extremely successful. Yeah.
Cystic fibrosis sufferer Jill Nealon talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about herself and her twin sister, Amy, getting lung transplants. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, BAFTA-winning actor Vicky McClure, well known for her turn in Line of Duty, is not only a hugely successful performer on screen, she's also one of the people behind Day Fever, the over-30s daytime club event in the UK, which is coming back to Dublin next month following a sold-out event last Saturday. Vicky spoke to Oliver Callan this morning from the set of her bomb disposal drama Trigger Point.
This is massively popular in all the cities that you bring it to.
Yeah, we've just obviously hit something at a time when people are sort of ready for it, I guess. It was actually my husband, Johnny Owen, he came up with the idea and just sort of said, what would you, you know, would you go to a disco in the middle of the day and listen to all the hits throughout the, you know, the last sort of four decades or whatever. And I said, that sounds like the dream for me, yeah. because it starts at 3 o'clock, it finishes at 8. You go in, you know, there's no sort of, there's no seats anywhere. It's a nightclub and you're there to dance. And that's what we do. We dance for 5 hours and it sort of starts quite, I wouldn't say mellow, but I'd say it starts with like a disco kind of vibe.
Very good. Bit of Motown.
And then bit of Motown, nice. Exactly. Creeps in with a bit of indie. And then there's a dance section that sort of pops off, if you like. And then we end with, you know, some real bangers like Bohemian Rhapsody, maybe a bit of the Beatles, Frank Sinatra. I mean, it can go it can go anywhere. This is the beauty of Day Fever.
So the dance hits would be 90s, wouldn't it? It's for a particular vintage.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we kind of designed it at the beginning with a view that it was for people over 30. But what we've found is that, you know, it's about people coming together, really. I went to the Day Fever that was on Saturday in London because I'm here. I sort of popped in and, you know, you get people of all ages. There isn't, we're not checking people's ID on the door. We just want to make sure you know that if you come in, you're not going to hear the modern day hits of today. It is hits from the past, really. And it's, you know, it's nostalgia.
Oh, gosh,
we've got
yeah.
these screens up that have got sort of images and videos of, you know, times gone by. And it just takes people back. And I think it's escapism. We all just want to sort of have a boogie and forget our troubles for a minute. And that's what it does. And it really does bring people together. The amount of stories we've had of people making friends and, you know, coming with their family members, mothers and daughters and that kind of thing. It's, you know, you wouldn't really expect to be clubbing with your mum, but you can now.
You can. You finally made it happen. Sorry, yeah. This is for me. I'm all up for this. Would you not bring back the ID at the door? That could ameliorate the experience going, oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you just know that, you know, the kids...
Fake ID check.
The kids, they know what they want. And, you know, when I was younger, I loved going out at night. And that was part of the, you know, the joy of going out. Whereas I think we've just hit that age where you've got so many things going on, whether it's the shifts that you work, whether it's childcare, whatever it may be, to know that you're home sort of for 8:30 and you're not going to feel too rough on the Sunday morning when you're doing, I don't know... the kids clubs or whatever, it just gives you that sense of you've been out, you've done something, you've done your 20,000 steps, you've had a bloody good dance and you can enjoy the rest of your weekend.
And plus you're not walking through a city that feels scary at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So this has got...
There is that. I mean, you know, in all seriousness, it is, you know, it isn't something I'd particularly want to do at 2 o'clock in the morning. And you know, it's all those elements that we kind of have figured out as we've been going, which has been well over a year now, where that has been the feedback. You know, women are sort of leaving the club at 8 o'clock, and especially now, it's still light. You know, you could carry on if you want to. You could go home if you want to. It's completely up to you.
is it still a romantic occasion for people? Are people coupling up?
Yes, I've got to say, we have had some brilliant stories there. We've had wedding proposals that have actually happened there and then, which has been lovely. We've had a few people tell us that they've matched, if you like. So it is somewhere where I guess, you know, you might find somebody on the dance floor, as you would have done back in the day, you know, dancing around your handbag. So, yeah, I think there is that element as well. I think it's really simple. You know, I think we don't want to overcomplicate it and seem like we've reinvented the wheel. We've basically just created a space where, one, the nightclubs get, you know, a double shot at getting, you know, the venue being used, which has been a really tricky time for nightlife.
It has here as well,
So it's been, you know, brilliant for the actual clubs. But also, I think people just want something that feels designed for them. Sometimes I go into, you know, you're going to a bar and you'll think, oh, I don't really know the music. Whereas you walk into Day Fever and if, you know, We Are Family is playing or something like that, a real hit, you just straight away, you're on the dance floor. And I think everybody's got the vibe now. They know what Day Fever is and they turn up and the minute they're there, they're on it.
They love it so much, they're demanding you bring it everywhere now. Brilliant to hear Vicky. Love all of her shows. Could she please bring Day Fever to Cork?
Oh, Cork would be great.
Oh, yeah, they'll dance down there.
They definitely would dance in court. Yeah, no, I mean, look, the plans are to, you know, keep reaching as many people and places as we can. I think we're at 25 cities across the UK now. And I came over to the first Dublin one, which was absolutely fantastic. I expected nothing less.
Of course.
But I mean, I love it over there. So I'm really glad people are enjoying it.
And you love Belfast as well. Obviously, Line of Duty shot there.
Yes.
You've done spent a lot of time around Belfast.
I have, yeah. I'd say over 10 years, really, that we was shooting over there. So I've got to know the city really well. And, you know, they're so welcoming. We've always had such a brilliant time shooting there. The nightlife is great. The food and the people, you know, we've just always felt very at home there.
And you're coming back, I believe. I'm reading the papers over the weekend. BBC has requested more episodes of Line of Duty. Several meetings have happened between the production team. And you have apparently have cleared space in your calendar to commit to making the show from January.
What can I say? I read the same news you all read. There's nothing has changed since I last spoke to whoever. So, no news, I'm afraid. I don't know where that's come from.
Not a denial, however. The fans are dying for season 7.
Listen, we love that. We see each other a lot at the minute. And I've got to say, like, it might seem like we're drip feeding something, but in all seriousness, Martin lives in Las Vegas some of the year. Adrian's obviously sometimes in Ireland, sometimes in London. I'm most of the time in Nottingham. Jed's here, there and everywhere. We're all very busy, but the last sort of month we've all been in London, so we've made as much time for each other as we can because we're mates.
Because you're best friends. And
we've met up for a curry, we've met up for a beer.
For a minute there you're pouring cold water and then it's back on. You're all hanging out in London. I mean, just very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. Vicky McClure there. Not outrightly denying a new season of Line of Duty is on the way on this morning's Oliver Callan. And Day Fever will take place in the Academy in Dublin on the 17th of May. And that's all I have for you on this new week, same trauma edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday with a mightier meteor look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.